Welcome to Tuesday's edition of Financial Survival, sponsored by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen, Melody taking care of other business today. For all your gold and silver needs, call us toll-free at 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. For the next hour, I'll be bringing you my opinions and commentary on the economic and political news of the day, Tuesday, April 26, 2022. Happy National Pretzel Day, everybody. It's also National Audubon Day, so get out your binoculars. Search your surroundings for your favorite cardinal, blue jay, yellow finch, or even little sparrow. Let's get started with today's market report. Gold went as high as 1912 today, hit a low of 1896 this afternoon. Is up in the New York after market. Spot gold up $2.90 at $1,902 and change. Silver down 18 cents at $23.53. Platinum up a buck, $932. And palladium up $55, although 2.5%+ at $2,257 an ounce. U.S. dollar index, good day today. Bear with me. I just lost that screen. Here it comes back. Up about 0.5%. Close at 102.34. 10-year yield, treasury yield, however, down a little bit to 2.75, we'll call it. 5-year, we've got another inverted curve. 5-year at 2.766. So we got the 5-10 inversion. 30-year at 2.8. 2-year at 2.5. Now, oil, WTI domestic crude up $3.58 a barrel today to close at $102.12 a barrel. And in the equities, mostly up in the foreign markets today, except for Shanghai. In the States, the VIX volatility index up 21%. Just shy of 33. And that's with the NASDAQ down almost 4% today, 514 points. Turnaround in Twitter going down, 12,491. Dow Jones down 809 points to close at 33,240. And the broader S&P 500 index down almost 3%, down 121 points to close at 4,175 and change. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is today's market report brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. Now, once again, the threat of World War III looms over the world as we bring you today's news. The war is growing from a battle over Ukraine to a long Washington versus Moscow conflict, according to the New York Times' David Sanger, wrote a lead article today. By casting the American goal as a weakened Russia, Biden officials are becoming more explicit about the future they hope to see. Years of continuous contest for power and influence with Moscow that in some ways resembles what President Kennedy once termed the long twilight struggle of the Cold War. Russia's top diplomat, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, warned Ukraine against provoking WW3 and said the threat of a nuclear conflict is real and should not be underestimated. Secretary of State Tony Blinken, in his first public appearance since returning from Kyiv, this morning was grilled by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about the administration's response to the war. Blinken, as expected, tried to shed more light on the administration's plans to send American diplomats back to Ukraine later this week. In addition, Biden's expected to nominate Bridget Brink, the current U.S. ambassador to Slovakia, to fill the ambassadorial post in Kyiv that's been vacant since 2019. Blinken shared his impressions of his time a few days ago traveling the countryside and arriving in Kyiv. State Department spokesperson said this is territory that Russia thought it could conquer within hours. Instead, it's free of Russian forces, with life returning to normal precisely because the Ukrainians, aided by our security assistance, are winning and push the Russians out. Blinken said Ukraine is winning and Ukraine will win. He's expected to tell senators the significance of the administration's aid request for Ukraine is not only to overcome Russia, but to deter future aggression from others who may be seeking to follow their lead. Not sure who he's referring to there. Could be any number of culprits, both small and large. Now, while Blinken's on Capitol Hill, the U.S. will be hosting a conference of allies at Ramstein Air Base in Germany, aimed in part at streamlining the process of getting arms and ammo to Ukraine. The conference also focuses on Ukraine's defense needs after the war, such as transitioning away from the Soviet-era weaponry. Talks in Washington come amid Russia pounding eastern and southern Ukraine today as the U.S. promised to keep moving heaven and earth to get Kyiv the weapons it needs to repel the new offensive, despite Moscow's warning that such support could trigger a wider war and nuclear conflict. For the second day in a row, explosions rocked the separatist region of Transnistria and neighboring Moldova, knocking out two powerful radio antennae close to the Ukrainian border and further heightening fears of a broader conflict erupting across Europe. No one claimed a responsibility for the attacks, but Ukraine all but blamed the obvious one, Russia. Russian misfire also knocked out a strategic railroad bridge along a route that links southern Ukraine's Odessa port region to neighboring Romania. The attack on the bridge, along with a series of strikes on key railroad stations a day earlier, appears to mark a major shift in Russia's approach. Up to now, Moscow's spared these strategic bridges, perhaps in hopes of keeping them for its own use in seizing Ukraine. But now it seems to be trying to thwart Ukraine's efforts to move troops and supplies. Southern Ukraine and Moldova have been on edge since a senior Russian military officer said last week that the Kremlin's goal is to secure not just eastern Ukraine, but the entire south, so as to open the way to Transnistria. 2 months into the devastating war, Western arms have helped Ukraine stall Russia's invasion, but the country's leaders have said they need more support. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said that more help is on the way as he convened a meeting of officials from around 40 countries at Ramstein to pledge more weapons. After unexpectedly fierce resistance by Ukrainian forces thwarted Russia's attempt to take the capital city of Kyiv, Moscow now says its focus is the capture of the Donbas, mostly Russian-speaking industrial region in the east. In the small city of Turetsk in the Donbas, residents are struggling to survive, actually collecting rainwater for washing up and drinking, hoping for an end to the fighting. In its latest assessment of the fighting, British Defense Ministry reported Russian advances and heavy fighting in the Donbas, with one town, Kremina, apparently falling after days of street-by-street fighting. In the devastated southern port city of Mariupol, authorities said Russian forces hit the Azovstal steel plant with 35 airstrikes over the past 24 hours. The plant's noticed the last known stronghold of Ukrainian fighters in the city, and also hold up several hundred, maybe even a couple of thousand civilian. Peter Andriy Yushchenko, an advisor to Mariupol's mayor, noted the number of those wounded will be clear once the rubble throughout the city is cleared. He also accused Russian forces of shelling a route it had offered as an escape corridor from the steel mill. Ukraine's military also said Russian forces shelled Kharkiv, the country's second largest city, which is seen as key to Russia's apparent bid to encircle Ukrainian troops in the Donbas from the north, east, and south. Now, for months, Istanbul restaurant Tarihi Balika tried to absorb the surging cost of the sunflower oil it cooks to fry fish, squid, and mussels. But in early April, with oil prices nearly four times higher than they were in 2019, the restaurant finally raised its prices. And now even some longtime customers look at the menu and just walk away and can't afford it. Global cooking prices have been rising since the pandemic began for multiple reasons. They range from poor harvests in South America to virus-related labor shortages and steadily increasing demand from the biofuel industry. War in Ukraine, a country that supplies nearly half the world's sunflower oil on top of the 25% from Russia, has interrupted shipments and sent cooking oil prices spiraling. It's the latest fallout to the global food supply from Russia's war and another rising cost that's pinching households and businesses around the world as inflation soars. Conflict has further fueled already high food and energy costs, hitting the world's poorest people the hardest. The food supply is particularly at risk as the war has disrupted crucial grain shipments from Ukraine and Russia and has worsened a global fertilizer crunch that will mean costlier and, more importantly, less abundant amounts of food. The loss of affordable supplies of wheat, barley, and other grains raises the prospect of further food shortages and political instability in Middle Eastern, African, and some Asian countries, where millions, if not tens of millions, rely on subsidized bread and cheap noodles. Vegetable oil prices hit a record high in February, then increased another 23% in March, according to the UN Food and Agriculture Organization. Soybean oil, which sold for $765 per metric ton in 2019, is up 156%, averaging $1,957 per metric ton last month, according to the World Bank. Palm oil prices were up 200% and are set to go even higher next week after Indonesia, one of the world's top producers, bans cooking oil exports to protect its domestic supply. And some supermarkets in Turkey have imposed limits on the amount of vegetable oil households can buy after concerns about shortages sparked panic buying there. Some stores in Spain, Italy, and the UK reportedly have also set limits. And German shoppers are actually posting photos on social media of empty shelves where sunflower and canola oil usually sit. And on an even dour note, Kenya's main power company warned that thieves are draining toxic fluid from electrical transformers in that country and reselling it as cooking oil. Phew. Now, back home in the States, home prices increased just about 20% in February year over year. That's according to the latest S&P CoreLogic Case-Shiller National Home Price index. It's the third highest increase in the index's 3.5-decade history. The 10-city composite annual increase came in at 18.6%. The 20-city composite was up 20.2%. Sunbelt cities continued to see the highest gains in prices. Phoenix, Tampa, Florida, and Miami saw annual home price gains of close to or over 30%. All 20 cities reported higher price increases in the year ending in February versus the year ending just a month earlier. Minneapolis, New York, and Washington, D.C. saw the smallest price gains, although they, again, were still in double digits. Craig Lazara, who's managing director at S&P DJI, said the macroeconomic environment may not support extraordinary home price growth for much longer. While mortgage rates began rising slowly at the start of the year, they didn't really take off sharply until March. Given that this reading is a three-month running average through February, it doesn't show much of an impact from rates. Mortgage rates, that is. That could be coming next, though. For a median price home financed with a 30-year loan, the monthly payment is $550 higher than a year ago, an increase of 46%, according to Realtor.com. Prices historically tend to lag sales by about 6 months, and pending sales, which measure signed contracts, have been falling for 4 straight months through February. The March numbers actually come out tomorrow. The realtors notice as we move through the spring housing market, we're seeing signs of cooling demand. Many buyers are deciding to take a step back and reevaluate their budgets and timelines. The housing boom is entering a different phase now, where once low mortgage rates helped offset these surging home prices, now fast rising rates are putting homes further out of reach for many, many buyers, particularly first timers. And that's going to spook a lot of potential home buyers all across the spectrum, and is probably a sign of cooling from the frenzy of the past couple of years. But because home inventories are still at record lows, experts are saying don't expect prices to come down very much, at least in the next couple of months. Redfin's chief economist Daryl Fairweather yesterday said the housing market is still tilted further in sellers' favor than at any time in history. There's the music. It's time for a first break. I'm going to take a breather. I hope you'll stick around and come back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. Stick around.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk TruthAndEducationRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at dgscoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And welcome back to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. I'm Dave Allen. Again, Melody off today taking care of other business. Call us toll-free, 1-800-375-4188, or look us up on the web at dgscoins.com, dgscoins.com. While you're there, sign up for our free weekly newsletters and blogs. Just look for that good old U.S. postal box. Quick one here, about 40% of U.S. small businesses intend to raise their selling prices by 10% or more amid already decades-high inflation. That's according to a survey from the National Federation of Independent Business. Overall, more than two-thirds of the survey respondents plan to increase prices in the next 3 months. Almost half of the small firms are planning increases of 4 to 9%. Reports suggest that many businesses are planning increases that are above the current rate of inflation nationally. Of course, consumer price index rose by 8.5% in March, the most since 1981. Almost 9 in 10 employers in the survey said they've had to raise prices to absorb some of the costs. Inflation started to show up as an issue in the survey in the summer of 2021, last year, the NFB said, and it's a novel challenge to entrepreneurs who started a business, particularly after the 1990s. The NFIB found that price increases are having a substantial impact on 62% of respondents and a moderate impact on a third more. No one said inflation had no impact on their business. Small employers have but few options at their disposal other than passing higher input costs on to customers, according to the NFIB. The main drivers of higher expenses cited by owners, cost of inventory, supplies, material, as well as fuel. Now, here's an aggravating story, I believe. 19 of the biggest companies in the U.S. paid very little or no federal income tax last year. That's according to a new report by the Center for American Progress, a Washington think tank. Some say that might be a oxymoron. In fact, four companies paid less than zero, including AT&T with an effective tax rate of minus 4.1%, Dow Incorporated minus 3.1%, American International Group, which, as you may recall, received a massive $180 billion government bailout during the Great Recession at minus 2.1%, and Charter Communications a minus 0.2%. Others in the top 10, or should I say bottom 10, include GM, Ford, MetLife, Chevron, ExxonMobil, and Bank of America with effective tax rates ranging from plus 0.2% to 3.5% on revenues, each in the multi-billions. Remember, corporate profits surged to record highs last year. That's thanks in part, anyway, to a lot of government Federal Reserve stimulus programs. The ideas of companies that earn billions not paying federal income tax is sure to fuel calls for reform, but proposals to raise corporate taxes have largely gone nowhere. 17 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act cut the official corporate tax rate from 35% to 21%. The 19 companies on the center's list based on the Fortune 100 all paid an effective rate of below 10%, or less than half the official rate. These top colleges and universities, the most recent application season was the most competitive on record, but getting accepted at several schools may have been the easy part for students. Right now, they have less than 1 week to decide on which school they'll attend next year ahead of the National Decision Day on May 1st. That's deadline for high school seniors to finalize a plan for next school year. For many, the biggest problem remains, how will they pay for their degree? Including room and board, books, and other expenses, families with students in four-year private colleges spend about $55,800 per year. At four-year public colleges, it's more than $27,300, according to the college board. Majority of college-bound students and their parents say affordability and dealing with the debt burden that often goes hand in hand with a copious diploma is their top concern. That's according to the Princeton Review's annual survey. A whopping 98% of families said financial aid would be necessary to cover the cost, and 80% said it was extremely or very necessary, according to the survey. Robert Franek, the Princeton Review's editor-in-chief, says that just the thought of navigating the financial aid scene is scary to the average student and their parents. But good news, many schools are incredibly generous. Those are his words. To that end, the Princeton Review ranked colleges by how much financial aid they award and how satisfied students are with their packages. When it comes to giving out scholarships and grants, which never have to be repaid, private schools typically have more money to spend. Franek said they're able to use their financial wherewithal to allow students to attend college without it being too significant a financial burden. At the private colleges, at the very top of Princeton Review's 2022 ranking, the average scholarship award is just over $57,000. Franek added, these schools are doing the near impossible, which is bringing the cost down below what a student can expect to pay for 1 year of public college. Well, the top five schools for financial aid packages? Private schools. First, number one, not surprisingly, given the source of this information, Princeton University, with an annual cost of $74,190, wow, an average financial aid of $61,928. Number two, Yale, with an annual cost of $77,750 and an aid package of $61,067. Third, Pomona College, I believe that's in California, with a cost of $71,980 and aid of $55,485. Fourth, Vanderbilt, with a cost of $68,980 and aid of $54,417. And fifth, Vassar College in New York, with a cost of $75,920. An average aid of $53,699. Now, the average sticker price of those top five private schools is $73,764, with an average aid package of $57,319, leaving an average out-of-pocket expense for students and their parents of $16,445 per year. $66,000. Over a four-year degree term. The top five of public four-year colleges, which predictably have much less annual out-of-pocket expenses, are in order here: University of Virginia, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, Florida State University, University of Michigan at Ann Arbor, and City University of New York, Hunter College. The average sticker price of those five public schools is $24,740 a year for in-state students, with an average aid package of $17,000, leaving an average out-of-pocket contribution of $7,740. That's still over $30,000 for a four-year degree. Interesting numbers, ladies and gentlemen. Okay, bear with me for one momento. Here's an interesting, I hope you won't find macabre story, too macabre anyway. Your end-of-life experience could be very different depending on where you live. It's according to a Policy Genius report that ranks the country's best and worst places to die. The report gives each state and the District of Columbia a numerical score based on seven factors like funeral costs and services, green burials, palliative care, Medicare providers, at-home deaths, and probate shortcuts. I think the big takeaway of this project is to get people thinking about the costs associated with the end of their lives. That's according to Logan Safran, a senior managing editor of research at Policy Genius, who adds, because some of them can be mitigated through planning. If you look at the top 10 and bottom 10, there aren't any specific things they all have in common. They're each kind of unique in their own way. Indeed, Vermont, ranked as the number one place to die, was among the most expensive for funeral costs, but scored highest for palliative care. That focuses on pain relief management, pain management, and emotional support during those pre-hospice days. Florida, known for its high population of retirees, ironically, came in last place, with the fewest Medicare providers per capita, and also scored low for at-home deaths and palliative care. Just quickly here. The best places in the U.S. to die, number one, Vermont, followed by Utah, Idaho, South Dakota, Maine, Colorado, and Illinois, New Hampshire, and Washington. The worst places, Florida, Alaska, Texas, Hawaii, New York, Georgia, New Jersey, North Carolina, South Carolina, and Washington State. Okay. Yesterday, Pam and Russ Martins reminded us in their Wall Street on Parade newsletter that the Federal Reserve controls the Fed funds rate. Unfortunately, over time, the Fed's also been granted a supervisory role by Congress over Wall Street's megabanks, alongside its ability to bail them out when its crony brand of supervision fails. There was an epic failure to Fed supervision in the lead up to the 2008 financial crash and the 2019 repo blow up, both which we've talked a lot about on Financial Survival. In both cases, the Martins say the Fed made trillions of dollars in cumulative loans at far below market interest rates to the trading units of these too big to fail banks to resuscitate them and cover up its own failure to properly supervise the banks. The convulsions the stock market experienced just last Thursday and Friday that we expect to continue over the coming weeks and months are tied to the failure of Congress to strip the Fed of its supervisory role over these mega banks. The Martins believe there's no better snapshot of the Fed's failure as a banking supervisor than this one that's called out every quarter in the Office of the Comptroller's Currency Report on Bank Trading and Derivative Activities. Listen to this. The table on page 19, table 14 of the current report shows that the 25 largest bank holding companies in the U.S. are sitting on $234 trillion in face amount of derivatives. Just five bank holding companies are responsible for 86% of that total, or $200 trillion of that exposure. The mega banks holding companies are the usual suspects: JP Morgan Chase, Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, and Bank of America. The table also clearly shows that the most dangerous form of these derivatives, the same credit default swaps that blew up Wall Street in 2008, are also concentrated at those same five bank holding companies. But here's what this particular quarterly report doesn't tell the public: the names of the financial institutions that are on the other side of those derivative bets. To get those names, one has to do independent research and watch stock market action. Last Thursday, the delicate tightrope that Jerome Powell had been walking with Wall Street's ticking derivative time bonds, out-of-control inflation, and the Fed's tardiness in raising rates was on full display in a panel discussion he was on. Listen to this brief exchange between Powell and the panel's moderator, CNBC's Sarah Eisen, that sent the stock market plunging. Eisen: the market has 350 basis point hikes coming at the next three meetings as of this morning. Is that reasonable? Powell: so I try not to comment on specific market pricing for things, but I'll say just this. At our last meeting, and this was in the minutes of the meeting, many on the committee thought it would be appropriate for there to be one or more 50 basis points hike. Were you one of those people? Asked Eisen. Powell: I don't disclose my own path. I try to lead the committee. The thing I want to say, though, is we really are committed to using our tools to get 2% inflation back. Inflation's much higher now, and our policy rate is still more accommodative than it was then, so it's appropriate, in my view, to be moving more quickly. And I also think there's something in the idea of front-end loading whatever accommodation one thinks is appropriate. We make these decisions at the meeting, and we'll make them meeting by meeting, but I would say that 50 basis points will be on the table for the May meeting. So, by the closing bell last Thursday, the Dow Jones had fallen 368 points on Powell's remarks. The market reflected further on those remarks and plunged by another 981 points on Friday. A total two-day wipeout, 1,349 points in the Dow. The two big-to-fail banks that are known to have the bulk of the derivative exposure were hit hard in the sell-off on Friday, as well as Germany's Deutsche Bank, which is known to be a major counterparty to many of the derivatives on Wall Street. Also reported to have derivative exposure to Wall Street are insurance companies like the bailed-out AIG, MetLife, Prudential, Ameriprise Financial, and Lincoln National. None of them fared well in Friday's sell-off. Get your goat, sure gets mine. Glad we're going into a break. Time for us to take a couple of deep breaths, listen to these important messages, financial survival. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it: to secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity. Invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cedarstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit DiscountGoldAndSilverTrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cedarstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cedarstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSE Talk Radio. TalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading, 1-800-375-4188, or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together, working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
And one more time today, welcome back to Financial Survival. I'm Dave Allen. For all your gold and silver needs, call the office at 1-800-375-4188. Our latest American survival newsletter has hit the streets. I have another article in this edition on, yes, you guessed it, inflation. Murray Mullen, who runs the Mullen Group, happens to be one of Canada's largest shipping logistic companies, said the other day, inflation is out of control at the moment. Not sure that comes as a surprise to many Americans. One aspect of that are rising food prices, of course, which Emily Peck notes that are changing our grocery shopping routine. Already kind of weird, she says, after the pandemic pushed more Americans to eat at home. High inflation's behaving like a boomerang, in fact, spinning and wreaking havoc in all kinds of markets, from cars to housing, from stocks to groceries, and changing the way we all live in the process. Forget credit default swaps. Peck notes that shoppers are starting to swap different kinds of meats, particularly as those prices climb. We'll call it derivative shopping. Others, she says, are eating less meat overall and swapping more veggies and grains. That's probably a good idea, given all the consumer agita inflation's been causing. Cost of beef is up over 20% over last year, and chicken up 13%. That's according to the Labor Department's March CPI report. Some households are even butchering whole chickens now instead of picking up the usual pack of thighs or breasts or legs, just to save money. More broadly, people are buying smaller packs of meat. That's according to Joan Drigg, a vice president of the consumer data firm IRI. She said if you watch the meat case at the grocery store, shoppers are rifling through some of those packs until they find the lowest price. I got to tell you, I am guilty of that, having done that the last two times my wife let me venture out on our family's behalf. Peck adds that shrinkflation is becoming more evident, too. That's where companies are keeping prices the same, but they're selling you less of what's inside, be it cereals, ice cream, or my favorite, Hershey's bars, just to compensate. So far, overall spending on food hasn't been increasing at the same rate as inflation overall, although I'm sure it feels like it at the checkout line. Household spending on groceries is up 4% on average in April so far, says the April market report from FMI, that's the Food Industry Association, again, versus annualized CPI of 8.5%. It's a sign that that's in March. It's a sign that shoppers are looking for ways to keep costs under control and their household budgets in the black. Heather Garlick, who's Senior VP of Communications at FMI, said consumers are really adept and they're nimble when it comes to their spending habits. But shoppers with incomes of less than $40,000 aren't buying as much fresh meat and seafood, according to the FMI report. They're turning to frozen meat or canned stuff instead. Spam sales are up 11% this year, and in 2021 hit their seventh straight year of record sales. We're also buying more discounted store brands. It's these lower-income shoppers who are most at risk as food prices continue to rise. Inflation is also taking a toll, though, on summer vacations, with more families deciding to just stay at or near home this year. Nearly 7 in 10 people recently surveyed by Bankrate said soaring costs were causing them to downsize to fewer, shorter, and cheaper trips this summer. Pete Gannon of Axios notes that for Americans sitting out summer trips altogether, cost is only one of the reasons. While almost half of them, 48%, say they can't afford it, 20% say concerns over COVID are largely driving their decision. Thus, more than a quarter of those staying put this summer say they just aren't interested in a week-long vacation. Wow, inflation, that is really, really mean of you. And last, but certainly not least, last week in particular was brutal for stocks. It was the third straight weekly loss for the NASDAQ and the S&P 500, and the losses seemed to build until the closing bell rang on Friday. In fact, the S&P's 2.8% drop last Friday was its worst day in nearly 7 weeks. Well, perhaps I should say in only 7 weeks. And this week is poised to add significantly to those year-to-date downfalls. Already happened today. With the Fed seemingly intent on hiking interest rates by 0.5 percentage point next month and by a total of over 2 percentage points by year end, stocks and their owners could be in for a rough 2022. As Pete Gannon observes, the Fed rate hikes can have roughly the same effect on stocks as kryptonite does on Superman. Well, late last week, Fed Chair Jerome Powell sounded like he was dead set on crushing inflation by raising rates rapidly. His comments and those by his policymaking colleagues have only pushed investors closer to the edge. Gannon says it's time to keep our eyes peeled on market-based estimates of inflation called break-evens. Break-even is the difference between the yield of a nominal bond and an inflation-linked bond of the same maturity. Since investors' money is on the line, they presumably have an interest in pricing inflation correctly. Now, we won't get new CPI data until May 11th, which makes break-evens the place to see if investors think inflation is going the way the Fed wants, i.e. downward, or not. If break-evens keep rising as they have been, Fed's going to either have to raise rates higher or threaten to. Either way, it could get uglier for stocks. Already in 2022, the Dow Jones down 6.6%, the S&P down 11.2%, and the NASDAQ down a whopping 17.9%. That's a third away into the year. But also blame the rise of e-commerce for at least some of the inflation we're seeing. Felix Salmon writes that we don't live in a price is right world anymore, where any given item has a knowable true price that's broadly unchanged from day to day, or even from store to store. Instead, prices constantly ebb and flow and are more unpredictable, which makes them much easier to raise. Call it inflation's deceptive sleight of hand. Prices, like phone numbers, are things we don't always remember. We simply look them up if we need to know them. Salmon cautions, though, as we pay less attention, we become less price sensitive, and that gives companies more scope to raise prices. Historically, it's been difficult for merchants to change prices. Economists talk of menu costs. If a restaurant wants to raise its prices, it needs to reprint all of its menus, often at significant expense. The restaurant menu, on the other hand, is a QR code. Raising prices is just a matter of changing numbers on a single web page. That's why Salmon says e-commerce outlets generally change their prices more often than physical stores do. But physical stores are now hopping on board. These e-ink displays at supermarkets can change as frequently as the price on Amazon. A single item from a single restaurant, however, can have a range of different prices depending on where and how it was ordered. So what's something supposed to cost anymore? prices sometimes seem as though they're the product of a computerized number generator. It all seems so random. Yeah, we got a loaf of bread. Here's $29. And there are the five-volume Jasper John catalog. It's $199. If you paid face value for your concert ticket, you're in distinct minority. Most prices are dynamic these days. Till recently, that worked in consumers' favor. Merchants competed to offer the lowest price. Now, Salmon says, it's working against us, especially as the attempt to maintain or even increase their margins in the face of higher costs, especially gasoline and oil companies. Americans are dazed from their most recent $75 to $100 trip to the neighborhood gas station, hardly blinking at the latest implausible price for steak, chicken, or milk. We might not be able to afford it, but by God, we're paying it anyway. Now, labor force participation rate, defined as the share of the adult population either working or looking for work, has not quite recovered from pre-pandemic levels. A new paper sheds light on one factor behind the shortfall. Interestingly, substance abuse. As we know, there's an acute labor shortage in the U.S., and this is one reason, alongside reduced immigration, child care issues, and ongoing concerns about, yes, COVID. Between 9 and 26% of the decline in workforce participation between February 2020 and January 2022, that two-year period among people ages 25 to 34, is probably due to a rise in dependency on substances like opioids and methamphetamines. It's according to findings in a recent paper released this week by the National Bureau of Economic Research. They're the same folks who tell us when the country is in and out of recessions, like the supposed two-month-long one at the height of the pandemic in early 2020. In recent months, the Department of Labor tells us that labor force participation has been increasing. It's now a half a percentage point lower than pre-pandemic. And that's been a big comeback from 2 years ago. 18 to 52% of that remaining shortfall could be from those struggling with substance abuse. That's according to Karen Kopecky, an economist at the Atlanta Fed and co-author of this paper. 18 to 52%. Pick data on how many more people turned to these substances during the pandemic, just not yet available. So to arrive at this conclusion, the researchers backed into it. They had a rough sense of how substance abuse pushes down workforce participation. Prior research shows that opioid users' labor force participation is 13 percentage points lower than the rate for non-users. For methamphetamine users, it's 16% lower. And the researchers found over 17,500 more deaths in the U.S. attributable to opioid and meth use than were expected between April 2020 and June 2021. Those numbers likely reflect an increase in abuse of these drugs, Kopecky says, although some could be due to a decline in available medical care, or a shift in opioid consumption toward the more deadly fentanyl. Using the additional death numbers, the study estimates that the number of substance abusers increased by about 2.8 million during the 2020 to 2021 time period. The increase in drug abuse is related to a broader problem, mental and physical health issues also driving the labor shortage. Long COVID for example, could be keeping 1.6 million Americans out of the labor market as well, according to one recent estimate. The surge in opioid abuse dating back to the early 2000s was already keeping an increasing number of prime age workers out of the labor force. The pandemic 20 years later worsened that situation. It's definitely in a sticky problem. By definitions, quitting such addictive drugs is exceedingly difficult. I know that firsthand. I have a kid brother who struggled with addiction, opioid, and now methamphetamine for over 20 years. He's tried rehab four times. This is his fifth, and I am hoping, praying that it is his last. Each time seems better than the next, but yet the stranglehold that demon has on him just won't let go. Hopefully this next time is another story. In any event, I believe that the labor force participation number is far more important and telling than the government's woefully underreported headline, U3 unemployment rate, in taking the labor market's temperature. Well, that's all the time we have for today's program. I'll return on Thursday, I hope, which will join Melody tomorrow, along with Wendy Wilson of Apothecary Herbs. I'm Dave Allen. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Todd, and to your loyal listeners for tuning into Financial Survival. Please be safe out there, ladies and gentlemen. Bye-bye. I wouldn't have to work at all.